And I'm going to confess, I'm a little bit nervous speaking in English because most of the speaking I do happens in Spanish. Like Pastor Ed mentioned, we've been serving in Mexico. It's been 16 years now since I finished Bible school and moved back. But I was actually born in Mexico as well, so it's been a long journey. It feels like home, even though I always look out of place there. I'm always the tall white dude who seems like he doesn't fit, but I love it. I was noticing my suit and my pants are getting a little snug, and it's not that I'm into skinny jeans, it's that I love Mexican food. I'm just, you know. So we're just so grateful. We're glad to be here. And I have to just say thank you, Pastor Ed, for hosting us. Thank you for visiting us. We've enjoyed your classes down in Mexico. Thank you as a church for lending your pastor to us. He's done an amazing job teaching class down there. I've had the privilege of translating for him into Spanish, and I just sound so much smarter when I'm speaking through, you know, for Pastor Ed, and I love that about him. And I want to thank you guys also for all the teams of optometrists. If I can, I'll just sneak in a quick story about this, even though it wasn't the main idea of the message today. But we had a team from the church just down there, and this woman came up to church. She'd never been inside our church building before. She's been listening to our music for about 2 years. We have an old kind of warehouse we were able to rent, and so the music carries out of the church when we sing. She lives practically across the street from the church, and she's been listening to it, but it's a very traditional community. She was embarrassed to set her foot inside the church. And the optometrists were her excuse, without seeming to offend her family, to sneak into church and see what this is all about. And so she was telling us, just super blessed to be there, first time in 2 years, and overjoyed to be a part of it. So thank you guys for offering that pretext to her and many others to set foot inside the church while you guys are reaching out. I have a text from Matthew 25 that I'd like to read today, if you guys would like to join me. This is about the sheep and the goats. I was just in Oaxaca, which is where I was born, and their specialty dish there is a goat. They call it barbecue, but what they do is they bury it in a hole. It cooks overnight, wrapped in cactus and banana leaves, and then they have all kinds of spices and herbs. I was thinking of that when I read this. But it says, when the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, he will sit on his glorious throne, and all the nations will be gathered to him. This is Matthew, I'm sorry, I didn't mention, 31, verse 31, up until 46. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people from one another as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put his sheep on his right and his goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to my visit. Then the righteous will answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or in need of clothing and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you? The king will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these, my brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. Then he will say to those on his left, depart from me. You who are cursed into eternal fire, prepared for the devil and his angels, for I was hungry and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison and you did not look after me. They also will answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty, a stranger or needing clothes or sick or in prison and did not help you? And he will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me. Then they will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. And I'd like to invite you, if we could just say a prayer together. Father, we thank you so much for your word. We thank you for your word that is true. It doesn't change. It doesn't fail. It's able to change our lives, God. And we pray that today, through your word, our lives would be changed. We ask that our hearts would be open to receive this seed like a good garden where your word could just flourish and transform us. We ask this in Jesus' name. As I was reading this, the thought that came to mind was a biography I'd read a long time ago about an Olympian athlete, and he had had the privilege, he had won a gold medal, and he was describing what, from his perspective, this experience was like, and he was talking about how he had trained literally for hours in the dark with no one ever watching. I read separately that a lot of the Olympian athletes, they may train over 100 hours in private for every second they spend on the running track. And so you can imagine by the time you make it to the Olympics, you've been through so much training, so much hard work. And then just to compete there for most is an accomplishment. It's the highlight of their career. But to actually win a medal and then to take home a golden medal, that to him, it was his dream come true. And he was talking about the moment when he walked into the stadium where he was going to be presented with the medal, knowing that it was being televised across the world, that his family, his friends, everybody he knew was watching this, and they were proud of him, that he had made his nation proud. And he said, I marched out there with the flag of my nation, and I was just proud to be where I was from, and I knew they were proud of me. And then he said, as I enter the stadium, you can just hear this applause. You can hear the crowd. You can see the cameras. And then they set you on the podium, and he's being crowned with this medal. And he said, I don't know how to describe it. There's nothing like it in this life. And he said, I just felt so accomplished. And as I was thinking about that and reading this story, you know, he's running for an Olympic medal, which I'm not going to say is a bad thing, but honestly, you and I have an opportunity to run for an even greater prize. You and I are in a much more important race, if you want to look at it that way, than the Olympics. You and I have something even more significant to look forward to. And as I'm reading this story, it stands out to me, one, that I need to be conscious. I'm going to give an account of my life. Throughout this passage and many others, the parable just before this is the parable of the talents. And there's a similar concept where Jesus is sort of evaluating how people have lived their lives, what they've done with what he's entrusted them. And some people are going to hear these words, well done, good and faithful servant. And that's a big deal. That's a really big deal. Just to know at the end of your life, one, I need to give an account to God for what I've done with my time, what I've done with my family, what I've done with this one and only, this precious life I get to live. What we do in this life matters. How we serve others in this life matters. How we love Christ in this life, it matters. And one day we're going to stand before God, and some people are going to hear. And I can imagine this for a Christian. It's going to be better, but the closest thing I can compare it to is maybe like what this Olympian felt. You know, someday, there's that song, I Can Only Imagine. And I think that rings true to me. I can't fully comprehend what it's going to be like to see God. But I understand that one day I'm going to give account to him. One day he's going to evaluate my life. And this idea of judgment, when I was a kid, it always used to scare me because my mom would talk about judgment and she would say things like, God sees everything you do. And I would be like, really, mom, everything? Does anyone have like a 7-year-old, 8-year-old that just asks those kind of questions? And totally irreverent at 8 years old, I asked, mom, even when I'm in the bathroom, is he looking at me? I was like, that's just awkward. Would God really do that, mom? And she would say, he's seeing everything you do, everything you do. And that would, as a kid, sort of scare me. Scare me straight was her method. But nowadays, I think this idea of judgment, this idea of being evaluated, which judgment, I think that's what it is. The evidence is being examined, and eventually there's going to be a verdict on how the evidence has been cast out. But for a Christian, and even for the disciples, you can almost sense a sense of expectation, where they were sort of looking forward to it. They would say things like, you know what? These light and momentary afflictions, they're nothing compared to the glory that's going to be revealed to us. And there was almost this hope in them that, you know, one day, I'm actually looking forward to this. I can't wait to see Jesus. I can't wait to be with God. I can't wait for him to look at my life. And if I can, by the grace of God, I'm going to live it in a way that he says, well done. I'm proud of you, son. I'm proud of you. So that's the first big idea I take away from the scriptures. One, we're going to give account, and for some people, it's going to be the best day of your life. Look at what he says. He says, come here, you who are blessed by my Father. And I love that idea, like for God to say, come close. It's that that invitation, we're going to dwell with him forever. And then it says, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. And like I mentioned in the parable of the talents, well done, good and faithful servant. I think that should be one of the goals we have as believers, for God to be able to look over our lives and say that. And at the same time, for some people, we understand it's going to be the worst day of their life. Some people are going to arrive there, and you can tell in this parable, they're surprised. They say, wait, what, when, Lord, when did we see you in need and not help you? They're surprised by the outcome. They thought they were doing okay, apparently, and it just threw them off to realize at the end of all things that they had misspent their one and only life. And to them he says, depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. And I thought, what a contrast. What a shame to arrive that day knowing that you missed it. You missed the mark. And I was talking with my brother. He's very into technology, and he was telling me about this company that recently has just exploded through technology. He says their stock value is like multiplied by 800% over the last year. And I was thinking, how did we not know about this, right? Have you seen that movie Back to the Future, where he kind of goes back in time, he sees what teams are going to win, what companies are going to thrive so that he can bet on them and invest in them? And I was like, man, how did I not have that Back to the Future moment, and how did we not invest in this company? But as I'm reading this text, it's almost like we're being given the cheat sheet to the test of life. I don't know if you realize this, but how many of you would like to arrive and God to look over your life and say, well done, good and faithful servant? And it would be great to know in advance what questions are going to be asked. It would be great to know in advance, you know, what do I need to do to get an A? And amazingly, he's laying it out for us right here. He's giving us the answer before the exam is over. This is an open book exam. So how many of you would like to know, how do I score an A on this test? I mean, if you don't want to, we don't have to, right? I'll let you get a B or a C minus, but if you would like to, the text right here, I love this idea. And it's going to hinge on this idea. He's going to use the phrase, unto the least of these. And he's going to tell us that we're being evaluated largely on how we treat other people. And I understand that we are saved by grace through faith. We did not earn this. There's nothing we have to give in exchange for it. We couldn't buy it if we wanted to. It was the free gift of God. But we also see in scriptures that faith without works is dead. And the idea being that a true and vibrant faith in Christ, eventually this faith that we hold inside, it's intangible, it's invisible, is going to be expressed in our outward actions. It's going to be expressed through the way we treat others, through the way we love others, and through the way we love God. And in this text, the idea Jesus is centering on is the way we treat others. And he's going to use this phrase over and over, unto the least of these. And so some of you know, we're coming up from Mexico, and in Mexico, one of the big things we're dedicating our lives to is an orphanage there. In Spanish, it's called Esperanza Viva. The English version of that would be Living Hope. And we've been able to rescue, at this point, it's over 500 kids who would otherwise have been abandoned, neglected, they would be living on the streets or in horrible situations. And we've been able to open sort of a refuge for them where they can come and be safe, they can receive food, they can receive education. And it's just flourished. It's an amazing thing to be part of. I feel like I get the easy part of the job because I get to live looking at miracles every day. I get to see kids that should not be happy but are smiling anyway. I get to see lives that should have been torn apart, but they're not. They're actually flourishing. They're thriving. I see abandonment, and then I see these kids grow into healthy families. I see lives being changed every day, and I love what I get to do. And I was thinking back on how this all got started. And so way back when, like Pastor Ed mentioned, Jerry was actually going to be here. My dad, he's the founder of the orphanage, and he was going to share this story himself. Unfortunately, he got sick. He couldn't be here with us. I know he's probably thinking of you right now, wishing, man, I should be there, right? And then he'll get out of bed and be like, I couldn't be there, but I wish I could be there. And he has this story of how it started. And so for those of you who don't know, Mexico is very different. The city life is very different to the rural life. I would say in a more extreme way than it is in the United States of America. And initially, he dedicated himself to church planting up in these mountainous villages in southern Mexico, extremely rural communities. He said he was literally in a town when they installed the first landline telephone. And there was a fight in town to see who would get the first landline telephone, because it was going to be a business. They were going to rent it to others. He said he visited a village once where he was the first white man they'd ever seen, which is pretty radical to think of nowadays, because you visit these same villages nowadays and the kids have cell phones and they're on Instagram. So it's been a transformation of culture. But you know, after spending years up in the mountains and eventually moving down to the cities, his idea was, we're going to church plant again, because that's what I do. I church plant, and that's what my church sent me out to do, was the church plant. And as we're driving through the cities, we're noticing the cities so different from the rural life. And in the cities, there's these kids, and they're just wandering around the streets, and actually at stoplights, they're coming out to juggle or to blow fire or to sell packs of bubble gum, and they're hoping to get some money doing that. And it was just kind of strange to us that you couldn't even drive to the grocery store without driving by these kids that just seemed abandoned on the streets. And, you know, after a while of this, after a few months in the city, he just got fed up. Like, I don't see any adults around them. I don't know why these kids are out there. So he pulls over at one of these stop lights where a kid is asking him for money. And he pulls over his van and he starts talking to the kid. His name was Juan. And if you can imagine, I have a picture here on screen. Hopefully this will give you an idea of what he looked like, although he actually looked worse. And if you can imagine, Juan actually didn't have a shirt when we met him. And just that look, you know, he's kind of no shoes, pretty hopeless. This is an actual kid that we met. It's not Juan himself because we didn't get a picture of that moment. But this is similar to how he would have looked when we met him. Juan was in rougher shape. He had these scars all over his arms. And he had joined a gang to try and survive on the street. He was 8 years old. And when you did something that, you know, displeased the higher ranking members of the gang, they'd put out their cigarette butt on you. And so he had just burn marks all over his body. Malnourished, no shoes, no shirt, and he's begging for money on the streets alone. And so my dad starts talking to him, and Juan shares his story. He was born to probably a 15-year-old mother who wasn't able to take care of him. Eventually they got separated and he started living on the street. He was so young that he got picked up by a government agency and put into a government orphanage. But the problem was he was being abused in that orphanage. And by the time he was seven, he felt like he was living in hell, and he thought nothing on earth could be worse than this. And so at 7 years old, he plans his escape, and he manages to escape from the government orphanage back onto the streets, where he realizes the streets are worse than the orphanage was. I'm being abused even worse. It's more painful. It's more lonely. It's colder. I have nowhere to... And so then he joins up with his gang to try and protect himself through that community, and it's just not going well. And my dad is talking to him, and he says, the Christian line I'm supposed to tell him is, do you know Jesus loves you? But he says, I don't know how I can look this kid in the eye and say that. I know it to be true, I just don't know how can I say that to him. So instead of saying Jesus loves you, I ask him, Juan, do you want help? And he started crying. He said, yes, please help me. And so literally they pick Juan up into their vehicle, drive him home. Now I'm a part of the story because they kick me out of my room and they give it to Juan. I have five siblings, so we all kind of bunked together in one room. We didn't know Juan. He was pretty wild, and so they gave him the own room just to be safe. And he lived with us for a while. And my dad's thought was, Puebla's a big city. It wasn't as big back then, but now there's over 3 million people living in the urban block. And his mindset, somebody must be doing something for these kids. There's got to be a church or an orphanage or some kind of, I don't know, humanitarian nonprofit, something helping these kids. And so he spends the next month trying to find a place that will take Juan in. And to make the long version of this story a little bit shorter, we just can't find anyone. We can't find anybody that'll take him. And my dad says sort of the camel that broke the straw backs was, I went back to the government orphanage. And we thought maybe we can find a better place. Maybe if I keep tabs on him, we can make sure he's safe. And the director of that orphanage spoke real bluntly with us, and he said, you know what? I get it that you're a gringo and you don't know how things work here, but I'm just going to spell it out for you. We don't want him. He said, this kid's so messed up. He says, you know what he's probably seen and done already? If I let him in here, he's going to ruin the kids I already have. We won't take this kid. We don't want him. Just let him back to the street and let what needs to happen happen. And this is with Juan present in the room while he's telling this, and he literally says, these kids have no hope. Just let them go. Juan burst out of the room crying. My dad goes after him. And he said for a while he was just indignant that nobody else would take him in. And while he was sort of simmering in his own indignation, he had one of those moments where it was just like God speaking to his heart. And this thought crossed his mind. He said, he felt God spoke to him, why are you trying to get someone else to do what I'm inviting you to do? And that was kind of the game changer right there, where he felt like maybe we're not supposed to plant another church. Maybe we're supposed to help these kids. And that let loose what's become almost a 40-year journey now, which led to the founding of the orphanage that we now serve in, which led to, I'm going to say now, a multi-generational impact, because a lot of the kids we took in the early days are older than I am, have kids of their own. And we're seeing families restored. But I love that idea that Juan was supposed to be hopeless. My dad actually named the orphanage Living Hope off a verse that describes Christ as our living hope. And he says, what do you mean there's no hope? There is hope. Christ is our living hope. Even these kids can have hope. And I love the idea that the church has a special ability to reach people nobody else thinks can be reached, to serve people nobody else really wants to serve. And as I read this text, that's exactly what Jesus is talking about. When he's describing who are we supposed to serve? What, you know, as God evaluates our life and he's expecting as part of our inward faith this outward expression of serving others and loving on others, who specifically would God encourage us to love on? Is it Bill Gates? Not that we shouldn't love on Bill Gates, but the people he's singling out here are the people that most of society would overlook. It describes them as the least of these, which it's the smallest, the least important, the forgotten, the ones everybody else would overlook. The ones, if you're not careful, you could actually not even notice they're there. And these are the people he's encouraging us to reach out to. I think it's James who's going to write, pure and undefiled religion before God the Father is this. It says to visit the widow and the orphan. And I love this idea that by serving these children, by serving those that others wouldn't even take into account, they would write off as a lost cause. What the world would consider a lost cause, in God's eyes, in the view of eternity, that day when we stand before him, he views as one of the best things you could have done with your life. You see that crazy contrast? Lost cause in the world's eyes, but then before God's eyes, is the best thing you could have done with your life. And so I'll grab onto this story because we talk about the orphanage and all that's been accomplished, and it's amazing. If you could get down there and visit, it's kind of flourished. There's been this domino effect where one thing led to another. We started the orphanage, but then sent the kids to public school. Public school sort of hated our kids because, you know, we had kids that were 11 years old. They'd never been to school, and so they're causing a ruckus in class. They took a test that said they belong in first grade academically, so they were put in first grade. So they're way older than all the other kids. They feel stupid because they were put in this class. They don't like being there. They're acting out. They're misbehaving. The teacher can't handle them. They can't control them. And they're kind of bullying the other kids out of frustration. So they're just fed up with our kids, and we're sort of fed up with them. We ended up starting our own school. And so now we have this amazing school that serves not only the kids from the orphanage, but also kids just from the community at large. And I love how when you start serving, you can start with something really small. Doesn't have to be massive. You don't have to have it all figured out, but often one thing leads to another. And I was looking through the things in this parable. He talks first about water and food. That's not overly complicated, is it? Like, I don't know how to solve world hunger, but I could buy a burger from the dollar menu for one person. I could do that, right? I may not have the entire solution to all Earth's problems, but I could share a glass of water. I could do that. And I love it that on his list, he starts with something that's just so simple. It's so basic. It's like if you're in karate, this is like whatever's beneath a white belt. This is something anybody at all can do no matter what condition you're in. You could share a glass of water. And I love it that there he makes this spectacular invitation accessible to any of us. You can start right now. You don't have to have been serving Christ for 10 years. You could share a glass of water. And you could have an impact on lives. And then as I look at this list, it seems to me to get more expensive as it progresses. Because after this, he's going to talk about, so you saw me naked and you clothed me. Even nowadays, usually, you know, a decent pair of clothing is more expensive than a glass of water. And as I was reading into these times, we have so much, such an abundance of clothing and fashion that didn't exist in those days. Like, clothes were fairly expensive. Most people didn't have 7, 8, 9, 10 pairs. They didn't have a closet full of clothes that they didn't know what to do with and eventually donated to Goodwill so somebody could buy for like a dollar a pound. That just wasn't the context. Like, to give somebody a full pair of clothing, that was, we could call that a sacrifice. Like, that most people wouldn't just have loose money laying around to be able to gift that at the moment. And then he says, well, yeah, I was sick and you took care of me. Has anyone been stuck with massive hospital bills? Okay. So I could buy a new pair of clothes probably easier than I could pay for somebody's medical bill, which you guys did already, by the way. Congratulations. But it seems to me that there's a progression in this text where it starts with things like water, food, then it might stretch our faith a little bit. We're going to move on to like clothing. Like it's a deeper sacrifice. And then eventually, to me, it just, the list, it goes on and the invitation gets maybe more intimidating, but at the same time, I would say more rewarding. And so we're invited into this amazing life with Christ. I see in this text, I was struggling. I don't always title my messages, but I thought maybe, and I'm not convinced about this, but I guess one thought I had was I could name this the divine invitation, an invitation to serve the least of these, an invitation to start with something small. You don't have to have all the answers, but you can start with something small. And then as we respond with what we're capable of, it's amazing to me to see how God can tend to enlarge, how God can tend to bless, how God can tend to connect us with people and ideas and just cause what started as something small to just flourish. So if I go back to the story of Juan, when Jerry took him in, he said at that time his goal, and this is Jerry, now he's 40-year missionary career, he's a man of faith, he's been shot at up in the mountains, they placed a bounty on his head, but he went and preached anyway. He's that guy, right? He's the big faith guy, he won't turn back. But he said at that time in his life, if we could get maybe a dozen kids off the street, that would be a miracle. And literally, that was like the most his faith allowed him to dream of. Maybe, he said, I think I have a big table. Those were his words. You know, he already had got five kids, maybe one more could eat at the table. It's not going to break the bank. Maybe two more. And I don't know how his reasoning went along, how he came to the number 12. Like, that's a big family, 5 plus 12, 17, like, that's a crew. But in his mind was, maybe we could do that. Like, if we did that, that would be a miracle. But nowhere on his radar was, like, 500 kids. Nowhere on his radar. We have 106 kids with us right now. That was just beyond what he thought was possible. But I love it when you just respond to those, I would call them invitations. My mom uses this phrase, divine appointments. And she would encourage us to think it's not coincidence. Sometimes some of these situations you'll run into, it's like a divine setup. It's almost like God is inviting you through the circumstance around you to respond in faith, to respond in love, to respond in grace. And so I just want to talk about that a little bit more. Like I said, the first idea that jumps out to me is we're all going to render an account of our lives. As I walk through the text, it's almost to me like they're giving us the answer, the cheat sheet. The open book exam. How do I score a 10? Wow, I'm being evaluated in part on how I serve others. In particular, the least of these, the overlooked, and those who can't raise a voice for themselves. And then as I look at this even more, it just stands out to me how both parties were surprised. Even the people that did well were surprised that they did well, or at least they were surprised as to why the Lord thought they did well. Because even the righteous responded, Lord, when? When did I see you in need and help you? And they're probably thinking in their mind, I never saw Jesus. I wish I had seen Jesus. I never saw Jesus. And they were surprised by the outcome. And that's where I just think sometimes I feel like we have a tendency to miss the moment. Where according to Jesus, he says, if you did it to the least of these, you did it to me. And he's inviting us maybe to see Christ in the least of these and to serve them as unto Christ. And if you look at it that way, it's almost like he could be anywhere. He could be all around us. And these invitations he's inviting us to be conscious of, I think often they can slip by unnoticed. They can slip by without even taking advantage of. But I feel like when you see them, often, it's an invitation. It's an invitation that requires a response. And I'll just share real quick about my story. I was born in Mexico. I grew up there most of my life. When I was 18, I left Mexico, moved to Carolina, lived in Charlotte for a while, went to school there, and eventually moved back to Mexico. And I remember when I graduated from Bible school, it was this big struggle to me. Sort of that perfectionist line of personality trying to get things right, I didn't know what my next step should be. And it was clear to me I wanted to serve in ministry. I wanted to serve God in some capacity. I just didn't know what that looked like. And there were several opportunities. We had just done this missions trip into Costa Rica, and one of the organizers from that organization invited me to stay on because I spoke Spanish, I was familiar with Latin American context, they said, we could find a place for you here. Why don't you stay on with us? And at the same time, I thought, maybe I'll stay in Charlotte, I'll keep studying, which could be a good thing. Maybe I could serve God that way. And then there was this invitation, serve a year in Mexico. It was kind of the least attractive one because there was like no pay, no diplomas coming out of that one. It was just come work for free and, you know, God bless you in heaven. He'll be keeping score. And eventually, like, I remember I did everything I knew how to do. I asked for advice. I studied. I prayed. I fasted. I did everything I knew how to do. And I don't know what I was expecting. Sometimes we get so spiritual, we're almost like, I don't know if I was expecting for the angel Gabriel to announce to me what my calling was, but it just didn't happen. Maybe a bright light, you know, like Paul on the way to Damascus and God would guide me. I didn't see any of that. And I was so frustrated that I didn't know what to do. And this sounds so unspiritual. In the end, I decided to go to Mexico because I figured it would be harder and I would learn faster. And I knew that, you know, I'm graduating, there were 103 graduates along with the class I was in, and I thought just about all of them are going to look to serve in ministry here in the United States. And there's so many qualified people, so many people, honestly, they're more capable than me. But I don't think anyone is even thinking about going to Mexico to serve there. So I thought maybe I could do something or I could serve someone that wouldn't otherwise be reached. So I go back to Mexico. And my first job assignment is I'm an administrative assistant, and then I live with the students of a Bible school we founded. Eventually, after we started the orphanage and the K-12 school, we realized we need people to make this function. Like, we need warm bodies looking after these kids. We need quality caregivers. And one of the best ways that we have found to identify them and to train them is through a Bible school we started. And so it's a full-time Bible school. It's almost like a military program. You sign up, you turn in your cell phone, 6 months. You know, you're going to wake up at 6 a.m. You got a schedule throughout the day. It's intensive. It's a full-time. There's no part-time job. You're all in for 6 months. And so I signed up to be the dorm supervisor. And that sounds pretty spectacular, right? You could put that on your curriculum. I was the dorm supervisor. But in reality, what it looked like was there were a lot of rough characters in this first course I lived in. Actually, as I'm talking to them, one of them had just been deported from the United States. He'd gotten into problems here, served a sentence, and the next day they shipped him to Mexico. And about a week after that, he shows up at Bible school. And I'm pretty big, but he was bigger than me, and he's had nothing to do for 7 years but work out. And I'm like, okay, wow, I don't know about this guy. And then I'm reading this other dude. He came from a prison in Mexico. At that time, this was not on campus with the orphanage. I should clarify that. We were in a separate location. But he's like, yeah, man, you know, I was serving out my sentence. He's like, I only had 3 months left, and then this helicopter came. He blew a hole in the watchtower. Machine guns railed. They were rescuing this big dude out of the prison in Oaxaca I was at. And all these guys start running out, and he's like, man, I so wanted to run, but I remembered I only had 3 months left in my sentence. And he's like, praise the Lord, I stayed, and I'm a free man now. And I'm like, wow, I'm going to be sharing a, you know, bedroom with these guys. And we had, it was a big house we rented, 14 young men plus me, 15. We had one shower. And again, we're on a military schedule, so we have physical like training, 6:30, 7, and then we've got from 7 to like 7:40 to shower and show up at breakfast, and then after that we have to show up at class. So we've got like a 40, 45-minute window to get these 15 guys all showered, and we took drastic measures. As a testament to my lack of spirituality and leadership, the best idea I could come up with was a bucket of cold water. So we had the standing rule that the door to the shower stays open. There's a curtain. Nobody wants to see you, but you got 3 minutes. And if you go over 3 minutes, whoever's next has the right to grab that bucket of cold water and just douse you with it. And that's how we kept the line moving. And I remember one night there, we set up bunk beds in these rooms. So we had 3 bunk beds, 6 guys to 1 room. I was one of them. And they're snoring so loud. Like, I didn't think that was humanly possible. One of the guys, I thought he must just be toying with us because it's not physically possible for someone to snore that loud in sleep. But I was wrong. It was possible. And I remember there one night, literally I couldn't sleep because of all the noise these guys were making. And I'm on my bunk bed, you know, working 14 hours a day for free. And this thought hits me, man, you're living the dream. And it was a really special moment. I felt like, I didn't see God, obviously, but it was like I was having a conversation with him, and I started remembering, you remember when you were a kid and you wanted to serve young people? And I had memories of, you know, when I was 15, 16, that was kind of my first encounter with God where I decided to follow him for myself, not just because my parents were Christian. And I had this idea, how cool would it be if I could do something in missions? And it started dawning on me, like, wow, these are the things I had dreamed of, and this here, to live with these guys and to serve them at this time, this is the dream. And I just felt so fulfilled. I felt, man, if I die tomorrow, I'm satisfied, I'm happy. I mean, I'm not in a hurry to die, but if I had to give an account to my life right now, this last year with these guys, I feel good about what I did with my life. I don't feel like any time was wasted. And so as I read this text, that's the challenge I take away from it. We're going to give an account. And honestly, the way to ace the test, it's so much more simple sometimes than we make it. You reach out to the least of these. And you can start with something as simple as just offering a glass of water. And maybe when you offer that glass of water, maybe they share their story. Maybe you listen to them, and as you listen to them, maybe there's an opportunity to speak into their lives or start a friendship. But it can start with something just so simple. Taking the time to listen. It challenges me just to be sensitive to those divine invitations, because I realize if Christ says, when we do this unto the least of these, and the least of these are out there, they're just, because they're the least of these, they're easy to overlook. So it challenges me to be sensitive to maybe those divine opportunities, those divine setups. Like when Jerry's driving to the grocery store with 5 hungry kids, and he doesn't have extra time to be messing around, but there's this kid at a stoplight, and there's something in him thinking, I should really talk to that kid. And he gets down and he talks to Juan, and the orphanage started. But I wonder, what would have happened if that day he said, you know what, man? I'm just behind schedule. Juan's going to have to wait for another day. And he just kept going. I don't know what would have happened. But it's a question I think is worth asking. I wonder what happens when we miss those moments. I don't really want to know. I want to make the most of the moments. So I have one quote here I'm going to close with. And it's by C.T. Studd, but he has this phrase that really impacted me. Only one life. He says, "Twill," in his original quote. I'll say, "And it will." Only one life, and it will soon be past. Only what is done for Christ will last. And I love that. I love that. I think the one thing that could rob us from making the most of these divine appointments is just busyness. It's distracted living. I look out across the room and I see people that are giving up their own time. I see people like Pastor Ed. I see what a beautiful church. What a beautiful crowd. And I don't think in us there's this desire that we don't want to help people, but I think if we're not careful, we could get just so busy. So busy with the day-to-day, so busy with the mundane that we miss those moments.